Okay, whew, Maharaj, boy, a lot of changes here this morning. So I just pressed to record. I'm going to go ahead and mute everybody. And if you can just give me 1 second here. Okay, so you're now the only one that can speak, and you won't be able to hear anybody else until you tell us to unmute.
Okay. Again, so excuses for the confusion. We're traveling sannyasi. We're changing time zones, and plans change, so we had to come over a little earlier. We got to come over a little earlier to Bali Maharaj's house. He's here. So we can go to the Harinam program tonight and talk with him about the different programs we're doing. So we made a PowerPoint show. We were planning ahead here. And, of course, I have the verse. Prayashash sarvo loke parayar dvandveshu yojita na vyatanti na hrishyanti yata atma gunash raya. Yeah. And, of course, this is finishing off the whole first canto, just one more chapter. And now I'm specifically talking, first canto again, we're mentioning this many times, is the preface to Srimad Bhagavatam. It tells who's speaking, what are their qualifications, who's listening, what are their qualifications. It talks about the purpose of the book. You know, it talks about the circumstances under which it was produced. So the circumstances under which it was produced are especially, you know, here in this last three chapters, how Maharaj Parikshit met the age of Kali, reward and punishment of Kali, and Maharaj Parikshit cursed by a Brahmin boy. And finally, I guess four chapters, Maharaj Parikshit meets Sukadeva Goswami. So next chapter, we're going to really see who is Sukadeva Goswami. And he was so transcendental, he couldn't distinguish between men and women. He was walking around. He just saw their Krishna consciousness and wanted to be ecstatically engaged all the time. So this verse is describing how about the purport here. I'll read this purport. The transcendentalists are the empiric philosophers, the mystics, yeah, I got them, and the devotees of the Lord. Empiric philosophers aim at the perfection of merging into the being, into the being of the absolute truth. Yeah, yeah. Okay. 1 second here. I'm going to set my Skype to do not disturb. Okay. And go back. Okay. Yeah. The empiric philosophers aim at the perfection of merging into the being of the absolute. Mystics aim at perceiving the all-pervading supersoul, and the devotees of the Lord are engaged in the transcendental loving service of the personality of Godhead. Since Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan are different phases of the same transcendence, all these transcendentalists are beyond the three modes of material nature. Material distresses and happiness are products of the three modes of nature. Yeah. And therefore the causes of such material distresses and happiness have nothing to do with the transcendentalists. The king was a devotee, and the rishi was a mystic. Achat. Therefore, both of them were unattached to the accidental incident created by the supreme will. The playful child was an instrument in fulfilling the Lord's will. Yeah. Okay. So the way this reminded us, of course, of Bhagavatam 1.2.11, Vedanti tat tatva vidas tatvam yad jnanam advayam brahmati paramatmati bhagavan iti shabdite. And of course this is from the, right here from the first, second chapter. In the first canto, the first three chapters are, you know, dialogue between Sutta and the sages. And in the first chapter, they ask their questions, which basically are, you know, just a fundamental description. you know, of the whole Bhagavatam. You know, and so in chapter two, he answers most of the questions. And so therefore, we find tremendous number of times these verses from the second canto are being cited again and again like that. You know, the whole series of them, you know, are being cited in the Bhagavad Gita in what is it, 10.4? 4.10? No, it's 7.1? Somewhere there, anyway. It's the Bhava verse, like that. Yeah. Yeah. And so this is one of those. Suda Goswami is describing Vedanta Tattvas Vidas. Learned transcendentalists who know the absolute truth call this non-dual substance Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan. Okay? And so this is like we have three, the same substance, right? But it can be in three categories. Sometimes it can be ice. Sometimes the same substance can be water. Or sometimes the same substance can be steam, right? Yeah. But it's all the same thing. So Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan, it's all Krishna. Yeah. But the difference is the intensity of the relationship. Like you can't use ice or water to run a steam engine like that. It's got to be heated up to the point where it becomes a gas. And then it can make the steam engine move like that. Yeah. Yeah. So we can realize this, you know, by different processes. And of course, as Prabhupada was saying, that Shamika Rishi was a mystic, you know. So his process is in the Astanga Yoga system, most likely. Yama, Niyama, Pratyahara, Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, Samadhi. Okay, like that. So, and Prabhupada says for every single technique in the Astanga Yoga system, there's a corresponding technique in the Bhakti Yoga system. Of course, Yama and Niyama is the same thing. You know, you have to get up in the morning early. You can't smoke and drink. So the same thing is there for yoga, Astanga Yoga system, if you're going to do it, Hatha Yoga system. I was reading one of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's writings, and he said the Astanga Yoga system of Patanjali in Bengal during the 19th century, the followers of the Puranas and followers of something else, they modernized it respectively as Raja Yoga and Hatha Yoga. And Hatha Yoga, as you remember, means simple. So what we know is, you know, these modern schools that come down that call themselves Hatha Yoga or Raja Yoga, they're coming from Bengali traditions, which modernize the Astanga system to make it practical. Because his yamas and niyamas are like leave the house, live in the forest, you know, wear tree bark, you know, which is totally impractical. But then pranayama, we do that by dancing. If you're dancing nicely, then automatically you adjust the prana, and all the tensions go out of the body, and you're chanting from the. It says one should chant with an open throat. Okay. You should chant right from your heart, loudly. And that will get all the prana in line from you, you know, to the external world, up the whole thing here, like that. Yeah, yeah. And then, Prabhupada also says, what's the word? Achahara? No, that's another one. Pratyahara. Pratyahara means to withdraw the mind from the external world. So same way, too. We're chanting like that, and we're focusing on Krishna in the heart, on the mantra, or the deities. And those are not a part of the material world. And so we do pratyahara the same as the Astanga yogis, but we extract it from things external to Krishna. So we're looking at the deities, if we have some realization, we know we're not looking at marble. We're looking at something which is within our heart, has internal significance to us. On the other hand, of course, is our system, which is bhakti yoga, which is engaged, which is really is Gandharva Veda. Prabhupada says one time he says Gandharvas, fairies. So in the Western tradition we have all this talk about fairies, especially with the Morte de Arthur, you know, the story of King Arthur in Camelot. And there, of course, he was really entangled with Morgan Le Fay, and she was the queen of the fairies, the Gandharvas, and they lived on an island, a floating island called Avalon. And Avalon was 90 miles above the earth, something like that, above the earth. And the Vedas is describing Avalon, Gandharva Loka, as I remember, about 90 miles above the earth. So it appears to be describing the same place, you know, the same thing. Okay, I got a phone call coming in here. 1 second, I will disconnect. Hello, Hare Krishna. We made a connection. We're online right now. Thank you very much. Okay, yeah, I'm online to Hawaii right now. We got the number. Thank you for calling back, though. Okay, yeah, when we couldn't get a hold of you, we were trying to find the number of Alabhadra. Okay. So our process is, basically our process is Gandharva Veda. We have Ayurveda, Vastu Veda for architecture, Danda Veda for political science, and Gandharva Veda is, you know, realization through music and dancing and drama. So actually we should add drama a lot. Lord Chaitanya, whenever he was, singing a bhajan or kirtan, it says so many times he was acting out, you know, the meaning of the song. So when you do that, it's powerful yoga, you know? And all the Ashtanga yoga things follow. I've actually seen myself. I've gotten so much knowledge of how the prana is flowing in my body. And I've been through really incredible things, like in India with the weather, which I could not have done unless I had very subtle control of the prana in the body like that, you know, so on. So this is two different people. Samika Rishi is a mystic, through the process of pranayama, and Maharaj Parikshit is a bhakti yogi through the process of chanting and dancing like that. Prabhupada says that Arjuna had a very difficult bhajan to perform in the battle of Kurukshetra, but he did it very nicely. So he was dancing for Krishna in Kurukshetra. People were shooting arrows at him. Okay. And then I have here, I included this verse. Again, this is from Srimad Bhagavatam 4.10 in the purport. Prabhupada quotes the Sanskrit there. But the actual verse is a verse that Prabhupada paraphrases it many, many times. It's the different stages of development, different levels of development of devotional service in our process. And many times Prabhupada paraphrases it and sometimes quotes the whole thing. So it's very well worth, you know, memorizing and contemplating. Prabhupada says in the purport to the Bhagavad Gita, according to Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, 1.4.15.16, the science of devotional service. Now this is interesting. This means one means the eastern ocean, four means the fourth wave, which is prema bhakti, and 15.16 means the beginning. And so right here, Rupa Goswami is giving a whole summary of everything he's discussed before. Adoshvada tata sadhu sangha ta bhajana kriya tato narta nivritti syat tato nishta srutish tata atas saktis tato bhavas tata prem abhyudan chati sadhakanam ayam premna pradra bhava bhavek krama. So ado, in the beginning, there's some little faith in the process that leads us to sadhu sangha, associating with the devotees of ISKCON, okay, or whatever movement, bona fide movement. Then that takes us to the point of actually wanting to become initiated members, baptism, initiation, bar mitzvah, bhajana kriya, the work of devotion. By doing that, by taking harinam diksha, anartha nivritti, all the bad habits go away. Looking at ladies' fashion magazines, reading men's football magazines. And then syat, we become nishta, very fixed in our service, always in Mangalarti, always Srimad Bhagavatam, even if we have to fight through the traffic, through everything else, we get online and participate in the Bhagavatam class, okay? Ruchis, then we get a taste. Everything else before is not really a taste of devotional service. It's actually relief from distress. Oh, Prabhu, I'm getting such a taste in Krishna consciousness. I've given up smoking. You know? No, that's relief from the distress. But the actual ruchi is a taste of the actual spiritual, eternal, transcendental life. And once you get that, you become attached. Asaktis. You know? You can't give it up. You're an addict. And because of that, then you finally become fixed in bhava, which is the immature stage of devotional service, and that matures into prema. And how so Prabhupada translates it here. In the beginning, one must have a preliminary desire for self-realization. This will bring one to the stage of trying to associate with persons who are spiritually elevated. In the next stage, one becomes initiated by an elevated spiritual master, and under his instruction, the neophyte devotee begins the process of devotional service. So this is one point there, because the Harinam initiation, Prabhupada gave that before people were following the four principles, and of course in the beginning in New York. And so I think what Prabhupada did is, seeing our condition as international people, he raised the standard for first initiation and lowered it for second initiation, what it was at that time of Bhaktisiddhanta. And so, but before, given the Harinam initiation, didn't mean you had to actually follow the four principles exactly. But after doing that for 1 year of chanting and then coming to the point of following, then Prabhupada gave second initiation, if you were fixed like that. By execution of devotional service under the guidance of a spiritual master, one becomes free from all material attachment, attains steadiness in self-realization, and acquires a taste for hearing about the absolute personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. This taste leads one further forward to attachment for Krishna, asaktis, Krishna consciousness, which is matured in bhava, or the preliminary stage of transcendental love of God. Real love for God is called prema, the highest perfectional stage. So there's the prema up there. We got three fruits. So that's kind of a comparison. Prabhupada says that they were both transcendentalists, but one was transcendentalist through one process, another through another process. And of course, it's a wonder of what was the actual level of Maharaj Parikshit. And he was a great devotee, says Uttama Adhikari, but Prabhupada says in the Bhagavad Gita, after becoming an Uttama Adhikari, one has to make further progress to becoming a pure devotee. So as I've understood from many sources, Uttama Adhikari begins at the level of bhava, like that. Which means that we have a mango. It's not a peach, it's not a banana, it's not a coconut, it's a mango, but it's green. And so Krishna can't relish it. So in bhava bhakti, we have to mature the mango into a green mango, into a ripe fruit. And so Bhagavad Gita 14:26, Mam chayo bhyacharina bhakti yoga na sevate sa gunan samatitaitam brahma bhuyai kalpate. So this is the point. If we engage in tivrena, where is it here? Mam chayo abhicharina. If we engage in abhicharina bhakti yoga, sagunan samatitaitam, we transcend the three modes. So this sounds like tivrena, it sounds like nishta, Actually, one time Prabhupada is talking about this verse, Nastapreshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya, and he said this word nishta, it means fixed in devotional service. Not chanting year round sometimes, not chanting and chanting other times. So he gives a very basic definition. And he says this is more or less 75% Krishna conscious. It's very interesting. So if we're at that level, always chanting and everything else, my goodness, Prabhupada is saying 75% Krishna conscious. And then we should be above the modes. Na sochati, na hakangshati. We lose a tooth, we have this happen, that happen. But we're fixed, like the guy here. He's fixed, like that. So then beyond that, we can, from that position, then we can make more progress. You know, from Nishta to Ruchi to Asakis to Bhava to Prema, like that. Yeah? Okay. So, another point here we got was that this is all the will of the Lord. Here is Maharaj Pariksit putting the snake garland on Shamika Rishi. So how do we know it's the will of the Lord? You know? So I always remember this verse when Bhishma Dev, because Bhishma Dev was, you know, in this very disturbed condition, and you know, Krishna, the Pandavas, all the Rishis were there, and Maharaj Yudhisthira was very disturbed, you know, like you as an official, a temple president or something. Maybe you have to chastise somebody. You have to, what do you call it? You have to condemn them not to come to the temple or something like this. And so you're feeling very bad about what you did. Did I do the right thing? Whatever, you know. But of course, Maharaj Yudhisthira, he had to take the throne. It required 640 million people had to die, and 640 million families maybe were bereft of their associates and their arms and heads and everything else here and there. So he was feeling very bad about it. And even Krishna couldn't convince him that it was his duty, he'd acted properly in devotional service, that it was the will of the Lord. And Krishna wanted that because he wanted Bhishma Dev to convince him. So finally, yeah, Bhishma Dev did convince Yudhisthira that, yeah, Prabhu, you did the right thing. It was all Krishna's plan, Prabhu. And the verse is, Aho kastam aho nyayam yad yuyam dharma nandanaha jivitum narhati krishtam vipra dharma chutashraya. Oh, what terrible sufferings, Bhishma Dev said, and what terrible injustices you good souls suffer for being the sons of religion personified. You did not deserve to remain alive under those tribulations, yet you were protected by the Brahmanas, God and religion. So there's the key. We have to be guided by Brahmanas. Always keep the association of devotees and ask of the nice devotees about what we're doing. God, well, and God in the Kali Yuga is in the form of His holy names. So if we're chanting good rounds and keeping nice regular kirtan with devotees morning and evening like that, then we all have a second source of you know, of confirmation, the devotees, Krishna who is in our heart, and Tesham Evanu Kampartam, and religion. So religion, what, you know, a regular sadhana, but also the four principles, like that, reading Prabhupada's books, getting up in the morning, and the four principles. So if we're actually protected by these things, you know, we got inspiration from Krishna, it was the right thing. We confirmed it by our sadhana, reading Prabhupada's books, and the four principles, and we confirmed it with devotees, then we should be convinced that what we're doing is the right thing. And even if we go to hell, you know, we'll have our japa beads, our kartals, we'll have Prabhupada's books, and there'll be six devotees with us in hell. So we can start a branch of ISKCON, and you can be GBC secretary for Suchi Mukhi, Kumbhipaka. Okay? And then Prabhupada's purport, I kind of summarized it there. As long as a person is fully in cooperation with the wishes of the Lord, guided by the bona fide Brahmanas and Vaishnavas, strictly following religious principles, one has no cause for despondency. Okay. Thank you all. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Oh. Any questions, comments, complaints, donations?
Yeah. Maharaj, you have to just give me a second to unmute everybody. So hold on.
By his power.
Okay, even, I muted everybody on start meeting.
By his power, on. Even the mute people can speak.
Okay. First of all, I wanted to say I thought the visuals were fabulous. I got a lot more from this class. It was really wonderful, Maharaj. Prabhu, if anyone would like to ask a question or make a comment. I, Balabhadra, I heard you. Go ahead. Now you can be heard by everybody else.
Thank you, Maharaj. You were saying that you quoted Srila Prabhupada about how if we are fixed in this process of devotion, so it's like chanting around, but that is 75%.
75%. 75%, Prabhupada said.
Yeah. So it just sounds to me like Prabhupada's being quite generous, because at least in my personal life, I'm struggling with the most energy. Even though I'm reading every day and I'm chanting every day, it just feels like Prabhupada's being extremely generous by putting out that kind of a number, isn't he?
When I heard it too, because also it says that the jiva soul can have 78% of the qualities of Krishna. Well, it doesn't mean 78% of the intensity. It means like 78% of the 64 qualities we can have. So when I heard it also, I was thinking, well, maybe probably being generous, you know. I don't know how he comes to that analysis, because maybe bhava, when you get to bhava, it's, you know, the percentages expand or something like that. So, I don't know. But it's kind of, you know, and also to the standard Prabhupada set, he wasn't talking about, like, you know, nishtha means some kind of high thing, like always following nirjala kadasi, you know, never thinking of, you know, the illicit sex or intoxication. But he said it was like always chanting your rounds, always, like, you know, principles. So it was basically the thing he suggested was just the basic standard, you know. Then after that, it was he said this. And so I don't know. I had the same thoughts you had, but at the same time too, I think basically we should be, even if it's Prabhupada's generosity. Okay, let's take it like that. Somehow or other, we've made progress, and so let's go on, you know, and try and make some more progress, and start, you know, coming to the platform of what of Ruchi, how you call it? Yeah.
Actually, I remember one story of I don't remember how or where I heard it, but one devotee said to Srila Prabhupada that he has examined his character and he doesn't see how in the world he's going to qualify for going back to Godhead. And Prabhupada said, I'm getting you into the back door.
Yeah, I heard that. And the problem is also one time he said, don't come in through the back door, you know. Come in, conquer your senses and come in like with like pride and dignity, you know. Yeah. But I certainly can see. I mean, taking the responsibility for being an ISKCON guru and whatever that means, you do have some responsibility for dealing with people. Even as a project manager, you got responsibility, you know. And so many times I want to become angry at people for not doing this and that. But I think, my God, what Prabhupada has tolerated in me, you know, my finding sneaky ways to gratify my senses for 30 years, you know, eating more burfi, you know. And, you know, my God, if Prabhupada can put up with me like this, I should be a little bit tolerant of other people and put up with them.
Thank you, Maharaj.
It's interesting because the numbers Ramananda gave me, this is exactly what I used to call in. 530-881-1212-914-990-497. But when I did like three times and it said this is an improper meeting ID. Yeah.
Any other questions or comments for Ruth?
Yeah, Maharaj, Vidodha Madhava Das.
Jai, Haribol.
Dhanavad. Great class. I was feverishly taking notes. I was wondering where Bhaktivinoda wrote about the modernization of the Stanga Yoga system.
Boy, yeah, it was a, you know, because that's the whole thing, is a sannyasi, you can't take anything with you, you know. So it was one little book. I remember I was reading it on my bunk bed in the ashram in Peru, and it was a small book. It was like an essay, you know, published by ISKCON or somebody as a small book. And it was kind of in the same general theme. I almost got to the name there, but I can't remember the name. If you knew some names of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's little books and stuff, yeah, it probably would hit me. But that's what it was, you know.
Is your PowerPoint presentation, is it something you share online, or is it something you just travel with and give to the devotees?
For what?
I don't know. There were so many beautiful verses and points in your presentation. I was just wondering. I know you have a website.
This one is just one I did yesterday. I put it together for this class, like that. Yeah. But
anyway,
then we have on the website. There's some PowerPoint shows for more general things like the Bhaktivedanta Library, and that one shows, like, you know, graphically all of Prabhupada's books and how they're organized. Then there's the first two cantos, Padapadma, and there's some PowerPoint shows that other people did of specific verses, key verses, and also there's the overview of all 12 cantos and the overview of the first two cantos. And those we spent a lot of time putting together. Those worked out over a long time, how, you know, the Bhagavatam is actually organized into these different, you know, sections of, you know, the Manvantara Katha and that kind of stuff. But this is...
Maharaj,
yes, sir.
Maharaj, I was just... This is Chris from New Mexico. I just... I wanted to say, well, you're quite expert at this. I mean, if you put this together in just one day, that's really quite amazing. It really added a lot to the class. Thank you very much.
Yeah, but I'm terrible on street book distribution. just doing books on the street, you know, probably, what's her name? Saraswati would probably, you know, drive me into the ground when she's 5 years old. Like that, you know. But the PowerPoint thing, you know, my mind works that way. Yeah. Yeah. Everybody's got an ability. That's the whole thing. Just try out so many things and you discover. I know one Mataji, she actually left her body. She didn't know an atom from a molecule, you know, like that. Very, very simple lady in terms of science, you know. But these Nobel laureates for the Bhaktivedanta Institute programs, you could see when it was coming coffee time, they're all kind of glancing at their watches. And then she had these fantastic, like, you know, and very nice, not just like sweet or something, but just varieties of flavors. And she had this fantastic of sweets and stuff for the coffee break. And after that, all these Nobel laureates were smiling, and, you know, they got prasadam, their intelligence had increased. So, you know, she was, I would say, one of the greatest Bhaktivedanta Institute preachers, you know, because of the prasadam that made these guys intelligent enough to understand the philosophy for maybe 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 1 hour. It's like everybody, you know, got their position. Yeah. There were some more points, too, in the verse there. Where is it here? If you go backwards here. Yeah. What I do is I just kind of like, you just kind of make a blank screen, then put a background, and then you find all these things on the picture. And you can just, Microsoft Word has very good pictures in their graphic thing now. Add something. You know, one thing is here, Prabhupada talks about the empiric philosopher's aim at the perfection of merging into the absolute, the mystic's aim at merging, at perceiving the all-pervading. So you got empiric philosophers like Schrodinger, you got Nobel Prize, of course. But there's, again, a very, very good book called Quantum Questions by Ken Wilber. And of course, you can get it secondhand on Amazon for nothing now. But it's just an anthology of different citations by all these big modern scientists, you know, Einstein, everybody, and it's so powerful. So Schrodinger declares this real strong pantheistic position. He says that physics is the youngest science, like that, you know? And he says that, you know, We should all realize that we're all part of this whole cosmos, that we can throw ourselves down on the breast of the earth and realize we're one with it all, you know. So he very very transcendentalist. And he empiric, of course, means through the senses, and philosophy for them means middle speculation. So sometimes science is characterized as rational empiricism. And so that's what he is. He's a big empiric philosopher. And he's coming to this point where he's not afraid of death exactly. He's not afraid of the world and its changes, because he really realizes that the integration and the unity, and throw yourself down on the breast of the earth and realize you're one with it all. Yeah, he's aspiring to give up his painful material individualism and become one with the beauty of nature, the symmetry, the life, the birth, the death. But then the mystics, they go to Dhyan, from Dhyan, and at that point they begin to see that there is some order, some organization. It's not just that we're all one with it, but that we actually, there's different varieties. For example, in this world we see men and women, and from that we get so many conflicts. You know, Romeo and Juliet ended in murder. Anthony and Cleopatra ended in death. You know, all these romance stories, if you look at them, the best romance stories are the ones where the people died at the end of the thing. Other than that, they have to stop it and say they lived happily ever after. Like that, you know. But when we become one with it all, we realize at that point that there still is our masculine and feminine. You know, masculine and feminine is not a material thing only. It also exists in transcendence. And so the yogis, they appreciate this. You know, the yogis come to the point of actually appreciating these different things, but they can't see that actually it's a person, you know, to be loved. They just see, the variety in the content like that. You know, that was one point I thought, you know. And different phases of the same thing. Let's see here. Advanced robot. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so it says that material happiness and distress are products of the three modes. So as far as I understand, all the variety here, the tables, the chairs, San Francisco, these are all reflections of something in the spiritual world. And their reality is created by the three modes, you know? Because in the spiritual world, their reality is created because they're objects of love. And they're vibhava or something, instruments. But here we don't have any love, so the reality is created by creation, maintenance, and destruction. Hankering, satisfaction, and what's the other one? Lamentation, like that, you know? And so because of that, I see when I'm crossing over the Bay Bridge in the evening with the sun going down behind Golden Gate Bridge and all these beautiful big, you know, big high-rise buildings and boats coming in from the bay, and I'm attracted. Wow, I'm hankering. I want to enjoy there, you know. But I think this is what Dwarka must look like. You know, this must be a perverted reflection of the beauty of Dwarka. But I want to enjoy it, and I want to go to the clubs, to the so many places of enjoyment there. You know? So that's when my thoughts, you know, the material happiness and distress are products of the three modes of material nature, and our happiness in serving the deities, in chanting the holy names, in organizing festivals, these things are not influenced by the modes of material nature. Yeah, yeah. So then what happens is we can enjoy these by serving them like that, you know? Yeah. Okay.
Maharaj, there's a Mataji that wants to ask a question. She was just hesitating because it'll be a little bit noisy on her end. If you have time to take a question.
Oh, please, go ahead, yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Nitya. You can unmute yourself.
Hi,
Maharaj. Hi, Shabbat Bakidoma.
I heard a little bit of that this morning, and I think it was the part of the class that I was supposed to hear, because I've had this question now for a couple of weeks, and I'm hoping that you might have an answer for me. So when we're talking about Nishta, Nishta is the platform of being sick, and if you're not there yet, you're going to have problems being steady, and I certainly have a problem with this. And I'm wondering, you know, as far as taking initiation and taking vows, you would think that you wouldn't want to do anything like this until you had actually reached the platform of Nishta, because otherwise you're going to have a hard time being faithful. So how, or being consistent would be the better word, how can you deal with the fact that you might be, you know, having problems being steady before you've reached Nishta, and yet, you know, take vows like marriage and, you know, initiation and, you know, so many other things?
Well, one thing is that my realization, and I heard Bhakti Vidya Purnamar made the same point, because of our German mentality, we have this, and I'm German, actually, so I can say this. My grandfather was an Austrian immigrant, you know. We have this idea that everything is like, you know, chopped up in a straight line. And so you are either on a Shraddha, you know, we call it Sadhu Sangha, Bhajana Kriya. It's like you go from one box to the other, you know. But what Prabhupada says, the whole thing is Shraddha. You know, whether you are in the beginning or the highest level, it's all a matter of maturity of Shraddha. You know? And so, yeah, when we're coming in the beginning, we have to be a. Prabhupada says one has to have a preliminary desire for self-realization. So it seems even at that level, it seems you got to do a little work. You know, you got to put up a little bit. You got to be a little tolerant. So right from the beginning, there has to be a little bhakti, a little bit of determination, which may be, you know, put under different names like that, you know. Like I came to Sunday Feast and this was going on, that was going on. But okay, I'll come again. I'll try, you know. And so there's a little bit of anishta, you know, right there to come and to experience it and try it out like that. So that's one thing, is that I think the level of anishta, I think many people, for example, when you get married, and in our culture, boys and girls are used to flirting, coqueteando in Spanish, you know, joking with subtle sexual, you know, not gross content, but, you know, the boys like to make the girls laugh. The girls like to, you know, agitate the boys with their glances and their pretty clothes. Okay, you know, but it's not gross. But maybe when you get married, okay, you make this vow. Okay, I'm not going to, you know, I know one girl, she was an actress, a devotee, and when she became a devotee, she finally made this vow that she wasn't going to take any more roles on television where she had to kiss guys she didn't know, like that. Which she said after that she started playing in a lot more children's movies than before. You know, okay. So when you get married, you take the vow. I'm not going to kiss any guys other than my husband at this point. You know, okay. But then after being married, sometimes you find you're still joking at work with guys, and basically you say, hey, this is not really chaste, you know. I got to, you know, stop doing this. So there are different levels of nishta then. And you realize, okay, now, so nishta, you know, okay, I chant my rounds, I follow the four principles, but, you know, there may be a little bit of weird stuff in the ice cream, and there may be, I got my rounds done, you know, somehow or other, when I'm on the telephone or when I'm driving to work, you know. But then you realize you're not, you know, not really doing it properly, so then you become more fixed. No, I get my rounds done before I leave for work. I look at the labels and the packages, you know, more carefully, you know, so the four principles, you know. So that's what I would say, is that there's certain levels, and so that spiritual master requires in the beginning, but after that, if for second initiation, Prabhupada says there's more consideration. It's basically the same thing. But now you want to see that you're doing it in the mode of goodness, like that, you know, rather than just doing it. You know, so you become, but you become nishta by following the things to the best of your ability. You know? Okay.
Yes, Maharaj. Thank you very much.
Okay. So try your best, and it will have a permanent effect.
Maharaj, this was such a great class. Thank you for the visuals. They were really wonderful. I thought they were fantastic.
Yeah, okay. Thank
we're
you.
Going to put a video up of this, so if anybody wants to review it or didn't see it, then they can just see like the video and presentation.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my obeisances. This is Yuga Larasa.
Jai.
Hare, well, I still had a question about, I would like if you can shed some light on it and a little bit summarize. In a few previous verses, Prabhupada in purport mentions that Krishna does not forgive if somebody condemns pure devotee. And then verses after that, it says that, I mean, today's verse was that Sringi was acting by the wish of the Lord. So how to understand that? Is that means that Sringi, if you understand that he did condemn pure devotee, and but he also simultaneously acted as a wish of the Lord. So,
by the I would say one solution with this that, like, you know, Krishna sees people have tendencies, and so then, you know, he uses those tendencies, you know, so the person gets some reaction, but not because Krishna put you in that position like that. You know, for example, like Rahu and Ketu, they're like really negative, you know, people. But in Vastu, they have their position. Everybody has to have their position. So they become guard dogs. You know, but Rahu and Ketu stay in front of your front door, I guess, one on one side, one on the other. And you give them some prasadam or something. And so then anybody that comes to your house, like the dog starts barking his head off and stuff, his territoriality. And so you know what's happening to somebody. You know, you got your doorkeeper like that. So the same way, you know, maybe Sringi had a little bit of arrogance. But maybe also to participate like this, he was a very nice guy in many ways, you know. So earlier it also says that Sringi was used to do this because he was a child and therefore he could be easily forgiven like that. So maybe he did. He did offend a pure devotee. But again, he was just kind of playing with his friends and stuff like that and carried away by, you know, trying to show off in terms of his friends and things like that, you know. And so he suffered. And he suffered for his offensive character. And you see, he's crying. You don't cry unless you're unhappy, you know. So he knew he'd done something really bad. And so he suffered for it. And maybe he took a vow not to eat mangoes for the rest of his life or something, or, you know. But it was, in his case, yeah, I would say he suffered. Krishna didn't forgive him for this. But Krishna arranged it so he could get it out of his system if he wanted to. In the Bible it says, two times they asked this question to Jesus Christ. We're all doing this because of the will of the Lord. You know, all these bad things are our destiny, our character, this and that. So Christ says, true it is that evil must come into this world, but woe unto him by whom it comes. And one time he says, for it was better he was never born. And the other time he says, it was better a great millstone, grinding stone, was tied around his neck and he was dropped in the middle of the ocean. So he says, yeah, it's got to come in, but you don't have to do it. Like that. If you do it, then hey, you know. So Sringi, maybe he had some tendencies, so Krishna arranged a kind of controlled environment where his envy of devotees could come out, and the result would be nothing but good. You know, Maharaj Pariksit had to be cursed, okay. So that the result was perfectly good, and the reaction for Sringi was like controlled, and so maybe he got it out of his system then, like that, you know, and got chastised for it, and then accepted his chastisement, just like Maharaj Bharata. He accepted his chastisement. And that was the end of it, forever. So that's what I would understand. You know?
Right, thank you. So it means that we still, if we have the pride or desires and we're being used, we still have to, of course, suffer the consequences we have to pay for. Because we had that pride and that desires in the beginning, right?
But now it's like being, you know, the teacher is controlling it, you know. Okay,
right.
Stupid, you want to do this, then hey, try check it out, you know. But now we realize that, okay, Krishna let me do this because I just wouldn't learn the easy way. And I had experiences in Vrindavan several times of like seeing animals and having a real strong impression of what they were in their previous lifetime, you know, and how they, you know, Krishna was chastising them and how they accepted it. They were saying, okay, we deserve this, yeah, it's, and we need this. We need this chastisement to really get rid of this contamination, and we accept it, you know.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Yes, sir.
Can I ask another question, please?
Please, yeah.
Yeah, because you were citing from the Bhaktivinoda Samhita, the Adho Shraddha verse.
Uh-huh.
And I'm looking at it as Srila Prabhupada translated in Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah.
And you had said at one point that up until the time where one achieves anartha nivritti, that
Ruchi.
The devotee is actually trying to get free from material distress, and therefore he's not really acting out of ruchi. But did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, that again. That's my smriti. I think maybe I read it also, but I can't really give a hard citation. But again, this is the point that is again. It's not like hard, like boxes, you know. So many people, you know, Adoshrad, I was going to go, Brahmandi Brahmatikom, Bhagyavan Jeev. We get a taste of something very high. You know, Narada Muni, before he was qualified, had a taste of the darshan of Vishnu. But Vishnu said, that's just to give you the taste so you have motivation to go on and do your sadhana bhakti, your vaidhi bhakti. So right from the beginning, we can have a little taste and stuff like that, you know. But mostly, we're doing devotional service because of the taste of freedom from distress, you know, and then I can do this without distress. But that's just my comprehension. And then later on, ruchi, that's something else. That's where we're really steadily, you know, tasting different rasas and serving Krishna or something like that. Again, it's not rasa yet, that's the whole point too. But there's a real taste of it like that. That's my what I was trying to say.
Okay, I was just having a hard time conceiving how devotees can pursue Krishna consciousness for so long without some kind of a taste, even if they're not free from necessary material desires.
No, again, it can be mixed. That's the point. You know, right from the very beginning, there can be some taste, but it's not called ruchi until that's the prominent feature. Prabhupada says devotees are devotees. They, you know, they're experiencing bhava. They join this movement. They chant with other devotees, other people, other devotees. Well, actually, the term is there. Actually, what it's called, it's in the Nectar of Devotion, Eastern Part, the two chapters on bhava bhakti, and it's called bhava bas. Bhava bas, and it's what's it called? Chaya. And Pratibimba. And Chaya means a shadow of Baba. And Pratibimba means a reflection of Baba. And so by associating with the devotees, because you're born in a devotee family, or because you want something from Krishna, so you do devotional service, associate with devotees, then actually you can experience Baba. But it's Baba Bas. It's a reflection of Baba, or else it's a shadow of Baba. But it's real, you know. And if we don't commit offenses, Prabhupada says, then it matures into real bhava. So there's an explanation of how like we can be, you know, by being in Prabhupada's association, doing devotional service, then we can get like some experience like that. You know? But on the other hand, a lot of it again is, oh my goodness, we're relishing how we got free from these complications with all these complications with the opposite sex, how we get kind of free from intoxication. And so that's, you know, not a taste. That's, I guess you might say it's a taste. Actually, it is. It's a taste of mukti. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Maharaj. I really enjoyed your whole class today.
Okay. I enjoy this association. even if I have to call four different people, run through the front room. Our host has to drive his children into the closet so they won't make noise. Still.
I'd give my cell phone number, Maharaj, so that doesn't have to happen again.
Okay. Well, I'm going to see you in 3 days, right, or something, no?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Maharaj, I have a question. Isn't the whole idea of Krishna consciousness is to please Lord Krishna and spiritual master and not going after some taste or something in return, like a business arrangement?
Yeah, that's exactly what I think, too, when I hear about this, that one can relish Krishna consciousness. I think, well, I don't want to relish anything, you know. But yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, anyabhilasita shunyam jnana karma dinavritam anukulina krishnanu shunyam bhakti uttama. But the one thing about that verse, which is the definition of uttama bhakti, it's activity empowered by the parampara, you know, for Krishna, with a conscious desire to please Krishna. And then the secondary definition is that anya abhilas. Anya means any, abhilas means desire. So anya abhilasita shunya, zero, you know, karma. So I want to enjoy mystic powers, I want to enjoy this. So Rupa Goswami, the Acharyas, they say he softens it up a little bit, because it doesn't say abhilas, it says abhilasita, you know. And so that it changes it from being desire to being motive. So yeah, we can desire to enjoy Krishna consciousness, but that shouldn't be our motive. You know, our motive should be that Krishna will enjoy, like that. You know, and so if we're thinking, you know, somehow that in my stage, I need the impetus, the vibhava, you know, of being happy in Krishna consciousness, so I can, you know, to please Krishna, I also should be happy. If I'm miserable, like that, if I go out on a, you know, say, to go to somebody's birthday party, and I'm miserable, then how is it going to be a good, nice birthday party for that person? So I should also see that I'm also happy in Krishna consciousness, like that. So in that aspect, you know, it's there. But beyond that, it says that actually a pure devotee has no ability to understand happiness outside of Krishna's happiness. So I think the same thing when I hear that. I don't want to enjoy any rasa. But the rasa should be there for Krishna to enjoy it, you know. And my enjoyment should be there because Krishna enjoys me being happy. You know, that it becomes complicated like that, you know. The gopis, everything else, they want to have a good time with Krishna because Krishna, they see that Krishna is happy when they're happy. So they want to be happy, you know, like that. Is it okay?
Thank you. Yes, okay. Thank you, Maharaj.
Yeah.
Time for one more?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. Then I guess we should go on with our sankirtan.
It was a very enlivening class. I really appreciated you demonstrating START Meeting has this ability to, you know, present something graphically and very appealing visually while you explain things. But you know, right at the beginning of Prabhupada's explanation of this Bhakti Rasmita Sindhu verse, he says, in the beginning one must have a preliminary desire for self-realization. And it struck me when I heard that, when you said that, it struck me that I've noticed over the years that these quick initiations don't work out so well. And I think it, you know, I think Radhana Swami and a few other you know, devotees have it right. They make the devotees wait. They increase their determination, their desire for it. And then they become more like steady devotees or, you know, committed devotees. You agree with that?
I've seen so many kinds of initiations in ISKCON, you know, and different countries, different places, and I have my experiences, my tastes, but in general, the standard, as far as like what I understand the standard is that you have to be, you have to follow the process the full process, 16 rounds, four principles, nicely, be integrated with ISKCON and its Sankirtan movement, and regular temple program for 6 months. Okay, if you're doing that for 6 months, you can be a formal aspirant. Then you talk to somebody who's be acting as a Diksha guru in ISKCON. You talk to your temple authorities. And then everybody, you know, is an examination. And everybody says, okay. And I explained it as like a, you know, a boy and a girl being what's the word, engaged, comprometido in Spanish. And okay, they can still change their mind, but now they're pretty serious, you know, about this, you know. And so at that point, then it's 6 months more, you know, with a ISKCON Diksha guru in his association, and checking it out and seeing how things are going, and if you have any problems with still with cigarettes or getting up in the morning. So that should be there. And then after that, then after those 6 months, and the temple president, he says, yeah, the guy's regular, he's fixing his regular service. And he takes the examination, which is not too difficult, but it requires some verses and stuff like that, even at that level. Then, to me, that's if you go to, you know, go like that, to me, it's, yeah, it's 1 year like that. It's pretty wholesome. And of course, it can be individual decisions like that. Actually, I have experiences like that. You know, people complaining about certain things, and so then waiting longer. And then the second initiation is at least 1 year or more. And myself, I generally recommend 2 years. After the first initiation, you go ahead, take Bhakti Shastri, study it, you know, engage in your regular service, whatever it is, get some realization. And after 2 years, take second initiation. And then Prabhupada, as far as I understood, he gave devotees who were like in India and doing really fixed up service the whole way, he would give second initiation after give sannyas initiation after 6 years. So that means basically if you do 2 years for Brahman initiation, four years more to study Bhakti Vaibhava, you know, and then okay. But of course now you've got to be 45 years old or something too. But that's the institutional arrangement, you know, in ISKCON. And I've seen, you know, really, you know, people deviating from it because they think they understand the person intimately and they're making adjustments and stuff like that. But for me, it's you know, kind of a workable standard. It requires sincerity on both sides. There's no substitute for that, you know. But that's my experience.
You said Prabhupada raised the bar for first and may have reduced the requirement for second. Yeah,
because as far as I understand, before, of course, the standard, what I hear, and of course I only hear part of it, you know, is that before the Gaudiya Math, the standard for Harinam initiation was, I mean, I've even heard one of Prabhupada's Gaudiyas say he would give it to children like that and stuff. It was just like giving, here's the holy name, now start
right.
Chanting and act properly, you know. And so when Prabhupada gave it in New York, he did the same thing. After the devotees took initiation, he told them they couldn't take any more coffee and donuts. Like that. It was published. And, oh my God, hey, Swamiji, you didn't tell us this, you know. But then in the Nectar of Instruction, it's the same mood. Prabhupada's talking about it in the same way, you know. But then, as I understand, before, in the Gaudiya Math, of course, there are different Gaudiya Maths, but in many cases, somebody could be a Harinam Diksha for living in the ashram and everything else for a long time, and maybe like, you know, 15 years, and not take second initiation. And so the standard was more strict like that.
Right.
Prabhupada says that Jiva Goswami says, in this age, Harinam Diksha is sufficient. Like that. If you're, of course, if you're following, you know. So that's what I understand, the Prabhupada adjusting it. He said, okay, these guys aren't going to be up to the level of taking 3 baths a day, you know, and no matter where they are. Like they're going to, you know, they're working at the bank and they're going to go for their sandhya, and the bank manager understands, oh, he's a Brahmin, he has to go to his sandhya and take his bath, you know. But in India, when I'm traveling like a sannyasi or something, people expect me to stop. And they say, oh, here's the bath is here, here's the tanks, here's the towels. They expect me to actually take a break and do a sandhya like that and take a full bath, Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Which is a Brahmin should do that. I mean, actually, I see associating with Indian Brahmins, it's you should do it. You know?
And that's how the Gaudiyas probably get away with some of the strict initiations. I think Prabhupada may have crossed over on his requirements also. In India, if somebody's in a strict Vaishnava family or a strict family, you know, they already have the sangskaras.
Yeah. I think he gave Bhakti Sri Maharaj first, second, and third initiation within maybe just like one year or something, or 2 years, you know.
Right.
Yeah. And devotees were criticizing, and Prabhupada said, you don't know these things. He said, he's already qualified. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One thing it says, too, I think Prabhupada says in that purport, I was noticing, Prabhupada says, one takes initiation from a highly elevated spiritual master. So there's no way on earth I would consider myself a highly elevated spiritual master. So when I'm giving initiation, I try to, like, you know, see my position. First and second class devotees, Prabhupada says, can accept disciples. Okay. If I'm on a second class platform, I can accept disciples. But, he says, you know, because they can't give full guidance, the disciples should also accept, you know, Uttamadhikari. So I only give initiation when it's very clear that Prabhupada is our acharya. Or maybe I got a little more advancement than you, maybe not, but whatever the situation is, we can always go to Srila Prabhupada, you know, to correct the situation if I'm doing something which is incorrect or something, you know. So Prabhupada is our acharya, our guru. He's the highly elevated spiritual master in ISKCON. And other people, okay, they may be on different levels. They may be Nitya Siddha associates of Lord Chaitanya, but that's individual. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I guess we should go here and get back to our work. But I want to thank everybody also. These classes are really nice to...
Maharaj, I also wanted to just say that Bhakti Dhiradamada Goswami was here for almost the entire class.
So. Okay, Jai. He's my guru.
Hare Krishna.
There he is. Tiv Raina. He's a ferocious.
Happy to hear from you.
maybe I'll see your body sometime. We'll probably be in India, I guess, maybe in next year in the for Gopurnima and everything else. Where are you, Maharaj?
I am in Lagos, Nigeria.
Ah, very nice. The Sankirtan is different there than in the United States. Every place is different, no?
Yes.
Okay.
I will come next year, my uncle.
Okay.
Maybe I have the opportunity to see you there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so Prabhupada ki jai.
Jai.
Ki jai.
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 Thank you, Maharaj.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Thank you.
Hare Krishna. Thank you.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you.